Hey everyone, thanks for coming out to the Ogilvy Day Stage. We're excited to welcome our next speaker, Jo Gouldy, talking about her book, Roads to Power. Jo is a professor specializing in history of infrastructure at the University of Chicago and Harvard, and she also teaches courses on the history of the internet and has organized collaborative laboratories for visualizing time with IBM and Google Books. Her book is not quite at the bookstore yet, but she has an interesting backup plan, which she'll talk about later. Please welcome Jo.
Hi, thanks so much for coming out. I'm Jo Gouldy. I'm a historian of technology at Harvard, and I spend most of my time thinking about utopias that work and utopias that don't work and the difference between the two and how you would know the difference. And I'm here today to talk to you about the idea of progress, the idea of the power of technology to unite different peoples into a single community of shared communications and common values. Over the last 10 years, many writers have preached a theory of how technology and history work together, which asserts that technology is extending communication to the point where once the digital divide is conquered, class divisions, democratic corruption, and indeed terrorism itself will vanish from the face of the earth. The theme of theories such as these is the promise of inclusion, the idea that modern technologies of information, since early in our history as a species, have extended the power to communicate across larger and larger scales. Participants, helping those who disagree to agree and helping the excluded, the freaks, geeks, and queers, the working class and women and minorities to assimilate to the modern world. And that account, I believe, has its origins in the politics of infrastructure in 19th century Britain, the first modern republic to have debated these questions, where another era of optimism about the power of technology comes with stern lessons about the dangers of exclusivity and control. My story begins late in the 18th century with the building of the largest single piece of technology ever built, a single coordinated system of roads and streets knitting together an entire nation. Now, this piece of technology was utterly different than anything that ever came before it. In the ancient world, if you wanted to get around, it was the roads that connected, that stretched across the European steppe were paved only by the tracks of animals. They were dirt roads. There was no paving whatsoever. The only pieces of pavement were military. The military roads of ancient Rome and Persia carried military vehicles, but almost never communities of travelers, never communities of merchants. Merchants met at the ports of the sea, and the tracks paved only by people's feet and the feet of animals. Now, this distinction kept two communities in separate places. On the one hand, the merchant road, on the other hand, the military route. And that distinction collapsed in the era of infrastructure. In the era of infrastructure, landscapes are coordinated systems for information. Public space itself becomes a technology for uniting communities in space. And information revolutions are designed by expert engineers and visionaries who use technology as a form of social engineering to shape the communities of the future. This is the origins of the infrastructure state. Now, this model, pioneered in Britain, produced thousands of miles of roads connecting far-flung parts of the nations across unprecedented wastelands. It was responsible for setting a new standard of highway pavement and building heavy infrastructure where none had existed before, making pavements for pedestrians, standardizing milestones and signposts, all of these things that are parts of the everyday landscape that become totally naturalized to you and me, part of the infrastructure revolution of the 18th century. And I want you to think about this in terms of an unprecedented expenditure of cash. Like, think of all of the money that was made to produce the internet, and then put that all in a ball in the 18th century, and think about what it means for the first time to make every piece of pavement, every piece of gravel in an entire nation look the same. You couldn't do something like that. You can't move money on unprecedented scales unless you have a powerful social vision, which many people buy into. This is about desire. Things that are this big only come out of incredible powers of will. And so this, This is exactly the reason why these roads were designed. The plans were a project of Celtic landlords like John Sinclair and Henry Parnell, Scots in the farthest corners of the kingdom, who had been reading in Adam Smith, another Scot, about the power of communications to break down monopolies and include previously excluded people in an economy. This is about economic participation. These were racial others. They weren't participating in the Industrial Revolution because they were the poor, dark people who spoke another language on the borders of empire. And they thought, here is an information revolution that can bring us in, that can make us co-participants in the wealth that they're experiencing over there in the rich parts of the world. If we have infrastructure, we too will have mills. We too will have an economy, and we too can participate on equal terms. And so they preached about this, and they envisioned thousands of miles of gravel roads connecting all of the parts of Scotland. And they imagined what would happen. The remotest parts of the kingdom would gradually be brought in, as nearly as valuable and important as those situated in the neighborhood of the metropolis. Scots would become accustomed to labor, and they would participate in trade, and soon the children of Scottish and Irish families would be sent to English schools, learning how to speak English, and soon ethnicity and racial difference itself would disappear. The colonies wouldn't be colonies anymore. Now, the advocates of Highway were producing a theory of history wherein they argued that technology itself was constantly making the world communicate more. And this rested on pieces of propaganda written in the 19th century. The promises of George Richardson Porter's 1836, The Progress of the Nation, Robert Philp's 1852, History of Progress, and Michelangelo Garvey's The Silent Revolution in 1852, which argued that within a few generations, thanks to these new innovations of electricity and speed, technology, all of the peoples of the world would be speaking one language. It was worked out by historians in a new theory of history that promised that this new transport revolution of road, rail, and canal would unite disparate peoples into one common experience. And indeed, that these were forming a collective, the lever of a collective leap forward represented by increases in industry and power. And school book versions of this thesis appeared, read by every young child in Britain, as the cult of Thomas Telford was assigned in public school, a cult of technology centering around the praise of the engineer as a model of self-help and self-discipline, a clear-thinking, rational, emotionless servant of social progress who didn't need cultural knowledge or political information to better shape the world of the future. Now, such stories as these forged a pattern of thinking that linked technological innovation to national progress. It suggested a double movement, whereby innovations in technology produce national assimilation, and national assimilation produces yet more innovations in technology, until the cycle of these two changes produces a Yeatsian vortex and sweeps humanity forward in one great movement, forward-moving momentum. And all of humanity, without regard to class, these theories suggested, would eventually have access to any new technology we can invent, from the automobile to the internet. In short, in order to sell the roads as an information revolution to government, 19th century writers increasingly minimized the degree to which technology needed a plan for a social vision. Engineers would keep making better technology and keep dissolving differences, eliminating languages, minimizing war, doing away with racism, because technology carries information, and information brings peace. Now, despite these promises, the fact that the roads were managed by experts who created structured exclusions to participation into the very infrastructure they were creating. These exclusions built into the technology from the beginning limited the degree to which infrastructure could realize its promises of social transformation. Because the utopian vision proposed by these engineers still depended, as all technology does today, it depended on revenue. And their vision broke down on the question of who would pay for the roads. Engineers allowed the state to pay for some of the roads, but their plans naively depended on funding from a very old system of getting money. The toll gates that required poor people to pay for the road, getting dunned a penny every few blocks. And what I want you to understand is that if Austin were 18th century London, in order to get to the bars on the other side of Congress, walking from here to there on foot, you would have to pass two or three toll gates and pay someone to get there on the sidewalk. So this was an innovation. This didn't exist for medieval times. Like, they have free and open roads. And this is really dangerous if you're poor, because it means that if you're poor, you have to pay to get to work. Radical authors like William Cobbett called for reductions in the charges placed on pedestrians, and they pointed to the obvious. If poor people wanted to work, they now had to spend money they didn't have. Now, poor people who felt this way, then as now, had limited ability to contact their legislators in meaningful ways. They used what they had access to, public space, out of doors. Where local municipalities failed to intervene, active rebellion took the form of turnpike smashing. In 1735, the Ledbury Riders, a gang, 100 and a gang armed with guns and swords as well as axes, hewed down the turnpikes, filled the county jails, and their leader was hung at Tyburn. Now, their resistance was aimed to sustain cheap access to the roads that had, within recent memory, been free to all. Mercifully, rioting worked. In the 18th century, riots like these succeeded in getting the attention of local elites and bureaucrats. And where the riots happened, the price of tolls went down. In a few forward-looking places, riots succeeded not only in lowering tolls, but also in another, more radical, forward-thinking form of legislation, the elimination of tolls altogether. Now, this is the origin of net neutrality. This is road neutrality. And it was a big deal in 1810. Progressive elites began to imagine a radical new kind of infrastructure, breaking down all the toll gates within each metropolitan area, throwing open the streets of the city to trade and commerce. In the 1810s and 20s, the city of London did this, becoming one of the first cities in the world to have both paved streets and open roads, free of charge. This road neutrality is what you and I grew up with, and we took it for granted. We never questioned that it made sense for people to be able to walk from one side of town to another or get to work in the most basic way without having to pay for public infrastructure. This is a political revolution on its time, and what they understood is that free infrastructure is the contract upon which capitalism rests. Now, things would have been fine if we had stayed there. But the roads did something strange, as much new technology does. Because the highways were creating a culture of mutual invisibility. Brand new, expensive highways tended to mean that wealthy travelers stayed in the few parts of the world where there were good roads. Now, meanwhile, everybody poor still worked on the parts of the roads that were free. With the consequence that rich people almost never saw poor people at work. And they never saw the poor roads traveled, and they never saw the poorer farms that weren't benefiting from the new technology. And this process of mutual ignorance of rich and poor created a cycle of ignorant investing that tended over time to intensify the divides between rich and poor rather than breaking them down. This mutual ignorance, this divide between rich and poor, meant a suspicion among those with money of any kind that of infrastructure that was designed for the downward dissemination of wealth. And that suspicion generated ideological qualms about how much to trust centralized government. And these qualms began to raise questions among people suspicious of the increasing power of civil engineers over the way society was run. The consequence of this ignorance was a political uprising amongst the rich. Rich taxpayers, when they lived in well-connected areas, well provided with infrastructure, resented paying for roads for the poor. And as a result of their organizing, a libertarian revolution took place that systematically dismantled the government side of the infrastructure state. After 1830, conservatives began to argue that those who use the road should pay for the roads. And they began to clamor every time a new government initiative came up that would pay for physical infrastructure. And they were successful. The state budgets for roads were slashed. Roads were privatized, much like corporations would do to the internet. A new funding was provided for new roads from the state. No new funding happened for roads on the national level from 1830 until the First World War. What did that mean? Well, the consequence of a political victory for libertarians was devastating for the British economy and for anyone who hoped that technology would cure all social ills. Roads literally crumbled in poor regions like the north of Scotland. Private entrepreneurs were recruited to turn the open roads into toll roads, and the result was that the toll roads became so expensive that even in an era of railroads, there are railroads in these places, but the farmers couldn't afford to get to the railroad because they couldn't afford to pay for the toll road that you had to take to get from your house to the railway station. So the farms collapsed in the north of Scotland. And ultimately, this decay resulted in crippling British trade at the very moment in the 1870s when industrial farming was taking off in North America, which is why Britain lost out, and the 20th century was the American century. This process created a 19th century rust belt in the north of England and south of Scotland, not at all dissimilar to the shrinking cities of Detroit, Gary, and Cleveland today. And Britain never recovered. The policy failure to provide access on either model led to a market failure and contributed to the decline of Britain's international trade. So here's an even darker story. Remember the potato famine. Ireland was about to be connected by a state-led program of railroad building right before the potato famine hit, but libertarians got there first by about 6 months. They slashed the budget, and the result was that laissez-faire ideology triumphed. A third of the island starves. A third of the island immigrates. And a third of the island is left behind, preached to by libertarian authors about how technology and the economy would surely lift them out of poverty. So what I want to explain to you about this period was the degree to which these social failures were increasingly countenanced by the very engineers and legislators who thought they were working to correct them. There was a brief period of utopian visioning in 19th century Britain, but it was followed by 10 decades of political apathy and infrastructure failure in which the poor were systematically excluded from improvements in technology used by the rich. That exclusion was built upon a faith in technology, the same quasi-religious faith that technology would take care of itself, that it didn't need social radicalism or questions about who was excluded, and built the praise of famous engineers into the public school curriculum and penned utopian visions of how great the steampunk world of the future would be. Unlimited faith in technology is hugely dangerous on a social level unless it is also accompanied by responsible visioning by those sensitive to issues of economic exclusion. So let me slow down here and ask you, does any of this sound familiar? The reinvigorated myth of technological inclusion subsists in a reinvigorated Whig theory of history in the form of the singularity, which is, in brief, a 1960s theory touted by mathematicians that the rate of technological and social progress can be systematically mapped. Ray Kurzweil's theory of the singularity predicts that by 2030, the advancing pace of technology will mark the end of human history as we know it, replacing us with sentient, highly intelligent computer programs capable of redesigning themselves and their offspring to improve performance to come. And theories such as these rely upon 19th century theories of technology for their justification, mapping as they do Moore's law of exponential progress as a function of events cited in the Encyclopedia Britannica. What do you think is in the Encyclopedia Britannica? It's the events of British social technological history. This is nothing other than the same story that drowned out social activism around technology in the 19th century. It is hugely dangerous, and enthusiasm for technology without responsibility drowns out very real contemporary evidence of an increasing digital divide between rich and poor that compounds rather than remedies differences of access, income, and privilege. Then, as now, fake histories of technology consist of wishful thinking. They drain the debate over who gets technology, threaten constructive conversation, and consist of a dangerous abdication of the realities of technological implementation to the hopes of political utopia. Technology can solve social problems, but only if it's designed by people awake to the dangers of exclusive economic systems, motivated and determined to secure a participatory world. So I want to do a brief Q&A, but first a little pitch for the book. The book is not here. You have to go where you can get it on sale. You have to go to Amazon. It's $21 on a Kindle, $35. This is a massive cut, $35 for the hard copy, but only here, only at South by Southwest, can you get Roads to Power with a puppy nameplate signed by me. I will be answering Q&A for about 10 minutes here, and afterwards I will be right outside in the foyer signing your puppies for Roads to Power. Smile, have puppies, talk about technology. Thanks, and can I take any questions? Yeah, right here. I think Africa is actually one of the most hopeful sites of this because of the whole SMS economy that's arisen in the last 10 years. The developing world is actually way ahead of us in terms of thinking about the technologies of participation, the technologies of emerging markets. After all, the Grameen Bank and the experiments in microfinance originate from women's movements in the early 1980s. So I think there's been a lot of research done on this. There's an excellent book called SMS Uprising, which is a story about the kinds of small transactions that are creating healthy, resilient communities in Africa. Vandana Shiva has written a lot about these resilient communities of women and banking and alternative strong community structures that actually force capitalism to disseminate wealth horizontally, creating a stronger, more robust economy that isn't plagued by these kinds of violent outbreaks, which are the necessary consequence of exclusion. So I think these are things to really pay attention to. There are things to pay attention to on the corporate level, on the policy level. No sector can afford to be ignorant of them. Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah. Anyone else? Thomas. So calls to action. My place in this is as a storyteller and a reminder. A storyteller about these processes in the past and some of the dangers that should look familiar to us. And the reminder about the necessity of visionaries among communities of geeks and entrepreneurs. We need social visions. So I have a handful of examples. The free road movement is very inspiring. The participatory movements of the mid-20th century in the developing world are very inspiring. But I think the room exists for a new manifesto calling for net neutrality on the mode of an open roads movement to extend rural broadband through the poor communities of the developed world and then start envisioning how we can work with the systems that already exist in the developing world to make them more robust, link them into the system of advanced capitalism in the developed world, and so create a more resilient economy without these exclusions and artificial barriers to transaction and communication that have become so natural a part of our technology. I mean, one way of thinking about this, and I talk about this in the book, one way of thinking about the information superhighway is that you still need points of entry. You need on-ramps for the information superhighway. And as we start closing public libraries in cities like Detroit, where the least privileged members of the community are the ones who are last to move out and become connected to the rest of the economy, when you close the public libraries, I think it's the Pew results still say something like 50% of African Americans and Hispanics have to do their major internet work in public libraries. And those ports are closing. So I think, you know, the highway is there. And it's a very important metaphor to understand because the story of the roads makes it very clear. You can have a great highway system that privileges the rich and makes a lot of information flow very quickly through a few privileged corridors. But the promise of capitalism, the promise that Adam Smith saw in all of this, the promise that the Scottish Enlightenment wrote about, everything that we think is supposed to work about democracy and capitalism combined, only works when the people who have been excluded have access to the market. If you don't build that in and you don't build those on-ramps, it's not going to happen on its own. In the back. It's a good question. It's a good question about the degree to which cell phones rope poor people into these structures of communication. Now, all of us have had experiences, if only briefly, of being separated from the rest of our technology and dependent upon a cell phone in order to get our information feed or communicate with our friends. We've had experiences that suggest how frustrating that can be and suggest the degree to which the sites of real participation. I mean, the best cell phone apps are those designed for market transactions. They're not the ones that are designed for voting or participatory democracy. So I think these are really important questions, and they have to be addressed in every sector, policy and nonprofits that are interested in them. And also they demand a lot of thinking about the ways in which Craigslist and other sort of lower tech sites work better to extend the communities. But all of you are in a position to do research in your own lives about this, because you all know people from varying stratas in society, and you communicate with them in different ways. And you have conversations at the checkout line in the cafeteria where you can ask the checkout clerk, do you listen to podcasts? How do you find a place to rent? Do you know about this website? Do you have an iPad? How do you read your books? Do you read books? You know, these are important questions to start asking if you want to start unpacking the myth that technology is everywhere and technology is going to go everywhere. The invisible boundaries that separate people from technology are all around us. And it only takes a little bit of shaking in order to see where they lie. I think we're about at time, so I'm going to decamp to the table just outside in the foyer. I would be delighted to sign your puppy plates. Please come talk to me. I'd love to hear from you. Please look me up. Follow me. I'm Joe Gouldy on Twitter. Joe Gouldy practically everywhere. And Roads to Power has its own stream as well. Please buy the book. Please tell your friends about it. And please rate me on the South by Southwest site. Thanks.
Thank you very much to Jo. She'll be puppy signing across the way, as she mentioned. And we'll be back at 3:30 with Dinah Sanders talking about Discardia, more life, less stuff.